Welcome to the podcast, Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. And I'm your host, Mike Allen. This week, Native Americans in Western Connecticut. Now, there's a common misconception that there are no more Native Americans in the western part of the state, and that simply isn't true. But their numbers are greatly reduced from the years before, of course, white settlers from Europe arrived. Well, our guest today has been studying this topic for decades. Dr. Lori Weinstein is Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Western Connecticut State University in Danbury. As an anthropologist, she's also participated in archaeological digs and studies, and she's going to be along in a moment to share her knowledge of Native Americans in Western Connecticut. This week's trivia question: the first law school in the entire United States was in Connecticut. What town was it in? The answer may surprise you. Stick around after the main program for the answer, because then you'll know the topic for next week's show. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is brought to you by our sponsor, Yale New Haven Health. Yale New Haven Hospital was the very first hospital in Connecticut. They opened their doors 200 years ago and later introduced the entire country to the use of penicillin and chemotherapy. Today, some of the brightest minds in medicine choose to work there, and it's the primary teaching hospital for the prestigious Yale School of Medicine. For more information, log on to ynhhs.org. That's ynhhs.org. If you've ever traveled out west, you're probably aware of the massive Native American reservations located there. The largest reservation in the entire United States covers parts of three states: Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. The second largest reservation's in Oklahoma, and it's larger than the entire states combined of Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Delaware. California has more than 100 Indian reservations. Well, Western Connecticut has practically no reservations. For the 110-member Scaticoke tribe, there is a reservation in Kent totaling only about 400 acres. And in Trumbull, if you can believe it, a minuscule 1/4 acre is set aside for the Golden Hill Pawgusset tribe, although their 100 members also own a roughly 100-acre parcel in the town of Colchester. In an earlier episode, number 51, in case you want to listen to it after this one, we discussed attempts by the Protestant Christian movement, the Moravians, to convert a number of Native Americans to Christianity in Kent and Sharon. Well, you're going to hear that mentioned again in this episode. A lot of what we know about the early history of Native Americans in Western Connecticut comes from a book, The History of the Indians of Connecticut from the Earliest Known Period to 1850. Also, subsequent books and articles that fill in the gaps left by that book. Also, studies from anthropologists and archaeologists, and interviews with members of Native American tribes and communities themselves. And much of what we've learned is displayed and taught at the Institute for American Indian Studies. That's located in Washington, Connecticut. Well, today we have with us Dr. Lori Weinstein, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Western Connecticut State University in Danbury. She works very closely with that Institute of American Indian Studies, consulting for them on numerous projects, and also she's a former member of their board of directors. Now, in her own words, she cares deeply about Native American peoples and understanding their histories. She'll also be the very first one to draw the distinction between her extensive studies and research over multiple decades and the reality of actually being a Native American. A couple of brief remarks before we bring on Dr. Weinstein. This episode focuses exclusively on Native Americans in Western Connecticut, not Eastern Connecticut, where there was a much different experience. One of those differences was the direct confrontations involving the Pequot and King Philip's Wars. They're also known as the Indian Wars No. 1 and 2. Both were horrible affairs with atrocities and brutality that can frankly leave one numb. Well, those were decidedly Eastern Connecticut Native American stories, and we're going to cover them in a future episode. Also, it's thought that Native Americans have lived in Connecticut for at least 10,000 years that we know of, and maybe even longer than that. Well, today's episode is only going to focus on the overlap time period since white settlers arrived from Europe. What was it like in the 1600s in Western Connecticut in terms of Native American populations? Where were the Native Americans living? I'm assuming along a lot of the rivers, going back and forth between Long Island Sound. But could you tell us about that?
Native peoples have never disappeared, and Native peoples have never been completely understood. There's been sort of a rebirth, if you will, of Native American pride and ownership of their own information. It's an important type of scholarship that is now taking place, so filling in all the blank records. And, you know, there were thousands of people living in Western Connecticut. The late Trudy Lamb Richmond used to, when I would interview her, tell me, you know, people were all interrelated. They thought nothing of going from what we call Lover's Leap, also called Matachewan, down to the Sound to go fishing, to share knowledge, to find marriage partners. People were moving around a lot because they had subsistence strategies that required them to do that. And when they moved around a lot, they were entertained and enjoyed hospitality from neighboring communities with whom they were interrelated. So all of Connecticut had thriving Native populations. It was in 1736 that Scaghtikoke was sort of founded. Many of them left Matachewan, Weantenock, and moved up north. However, not everyone left. You know, people are still, I don't want to say hanging around, but going about their business, whether they're selling brooms and baskets. I mean, there was a whole community in Cornwall where Native peoples were living. That's been written about. That's kind of cool. These are Weantenock, Mohican people. You know, they're still living there.
Probably 2 years ago, when I first got to know you, we talked about an article you had written about Native Americans along the Still River in Danbury and Brookfield and New Milford. And it's fascinating to listen to you tell these stories about where they were, you know, who they were, what they did. Could you just share a little bit of that with us, your knowledge about the Native Americans along that stretch of water?
They were living through the early 20th century, and a lot of archaeology was done along the Still River, both by amateurs as well as professional folks that have the information about where these people were going. Indian Betty, who was living, I believe, in Ridgefield and Redding, and was coming through selling baskets, heading to somewhere over in New York. There were a variety of other Native people who were living in the area and were well-known. I think it was Indian Mary, who was near what we would now call the Mall. She had a place on Joe's Hill Road. This was also known as a Native settlement. There were a lot of Indians living along Joe Hill's Road. And you find Native people basically living in areas that were sort of off the beaten path and away from a white settlement, but they were coming through. Beaver Brook and Turkey Hill Road, these were also well-known Native settlements. One of the things is that the Still River, you know, flows into the Housatonic and up in the Weantenock lands and near the falls. Chances are there are some really significant sites, but because of the building of the Bridgeport wood finishing factory and the railroad trains that came in to serve that, some of that information is lost. Native peoples traditionally planted in the floodplains because that would make sense. You want these very rich, fertile lands where you can plant your corn, beans, and squash. All of Western Connecticut, those fertile lands of the Still and Housatonic River, are places of the Native past as well as the Native present that is still known in terms of the people. You know, they talk about that. They're still there. They're living among the rest of us.
In Western Connecticut, generally speaking, the Paugusset tribe was prominent. If you look at a map, and a lot of people know about this map from the 1600s, it shows tribal names, Mohegans and Paugussets and the Hamannassets and the Podunks around the state of Connecticut. And you could almost come to the conclusion that the larger names are more like county names and that the smaller names are more like town or village names. So you get down to, you know, Pomperog and Pudatuck. Could you explain the difference between those sort of larger print names on that map and the smaller print names?
That's a good question. I think it depends upon the maps that you're looking at, because there were so many of the maps that were done by various colonial observers. So I'm not sure that they're absolutely true to fact. It was just through colonial eyes, not through native eyes. So yes, one of the things that's been done recently is to look at some of the terminology that colonists had that seems to have reified some of these names as tribal kinds of communities. But in fact, what I think there was is there were sachemships that sort of grew in power because of colonial interaction and conflict and disease, et cetera, in the early 17th century. So people amalgamated and made them a little bit more distinct. But there were also a lot of smaller communities that were affiliated with these sachemships. And a lot of the names that you see on maps, like Pacquiao near Danbury, was probably just a community. It wouldn't have been a tribal kind of designation. Chances are a lot of the terms that you see are based upon smaller communities. You know, I've been looking at a lot of maps myself for the work that we're doing, and it gets very confusing. I will have to say that.
Was a Pudatuck a Pawgusset? In other words, was Pawgusset sort of an umbrella term for a broad area of Native Americans, and maybe there were sub-tribes within that group, or is that completely wrong?
Well, that's a myth, and I sort of bought into it for a while. Calling it, you know, the Pawgusset tribes, because Wojciechowski, when he wrote his 92 book about Western Connecticut, used that term, and a few other people did, and even I did. But I think that's a misnomer. I think these are not Pawgusset tribes. It's like talking about a Wappinger Confederacy or a Mattabesic Confederacy. Those things did not exist. What you have are a group of smaller sachemships, probably. So you've got Pequannock, Pawgusset, Pudatuck, Wiantanuck, along the Housatonic Rivers. And they're all semi-distinct, but all interrelated.
So let's talk for a second about the distinction, the eastern half of Connecticut and the western half of Connecticut. And when you talk about historically in the 1600s, where there was the Pequot War followed by King Philip's War, and King Philip's War was just a ghastly abomination of war, Western Connecticut wasn't as much involved. Is that mainly because the Connecticut River separated them, or why?
Yes. Eastern Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and especially into the Connecticut River Valley. Seems to be areas where it took place, and up into Vermont and New Hampshire a little bit. But certainly everyone was affected throughout New England. And this had reverberations in Western Connecticut because the colonists were paranoid about Native reprisal, that even though their Indians were theoretically passive in all of this, you see all these laws that were passed in the 17th century into the 18th century about making sure that Native people were not out roaming at night, that they were staying put, that they weren't going to be defecting to the French. That was another thing, the French and Indian wars that took place in the middle of the 18th century. They were very concerned about all of these things, so they never really trusted Native peoples.
In the past, when English settlers were first getting here and the Moravian influence, so there was some attempts to convert Native Americans to Christianity. Can you tell me how prevalent that was in Western Connecticut?
So the Moravians were from Pennsylvania. They came in. They wanted their own minister. So they went down to Pennsylvania to request a minister, who then came to Scaghtikoke and taught them. And one reason to have ministers is that, especially the Moravians, they didn't try to force them to change a lot. They weren't forcing them to live like English people, you know, with houses, etc. They sort of fit into the community, and they actually lived with them. and taught them English through the Bibles, etc., and they tried to help defend them in their land.
In Western Connecticut, there's a big difference also with Eastern Connecticut in that there are, in Eastern Connecticut, actual large tracts of land, not as large as what you would get out in the Western United States, but dedicated federal Native American reservations. We don't see that so much in Western Connecticut, the largest, I believe, being the Scaghtikoke land in Kent. First of all, is that true? What kind of reservations are there in Western Connecticut?
Well, that's primarily it. And then you've got Trumbull, Pawtucket. So yeah, there really aren't that many. Scaghtikoke is the only one. They should be having a federal reservation because they did win federal recognition and then it was rescinded back in the early part of this century, which was horrible. But yeah, there aren't that many big reservations.
When you talk about how we remember Native Americans in Western Connecticut, there is, of course, now this Institute for American Indian Studies, which has been around for quite some time. And there are people such as yourself who work in this field and bring this to life with papers and articles and speeches and the like. One of the other ways that we keep some sort of connection to those days is through the way we have named various roads and forests and different lands. The Pawtucket State Forest in New Fairfield, the Upper and Lower Pawtucket State Parks in Newtown, Pocono Road in Brookfield, Lake Kenosha, Danbury, Saugatuck Reservoir, Redding. From your perspective, do you get a feeling of it's a good thing we're doing this or we should be doing more? Or how's that hit you?
It's kind of like this bumper sticker that I remember that said, we kill the Indians, but commemorate them with place names. So I'm not that keen about it. At least there's some sense that Native Americans were here, and it would be important to say that they're still here. There's a very good book written by Jean O'Brien. It was a book called Firsting and Lasting. But she wrote about that, you know, we name monuments, roads, things to Native peoples, but then we seem to indicate that these monuments are commemorating the last of the Indians, and they're not. The Native people are very much here, and so even in Western Connecticut, you've got information saying that the Indians are gone, and yet the research that I've been doing, that Dr. Lucien Lavin and some other people have been doing, all indicate that Native peoples were basically hiding in plain sight. They were there, they were making baskets, they were selling their wares, they were connecting themselves with larger communities by going on the road and selling their wares and staying with kin. They were visiting all the time. They were actually, you know, living their traditional lives. They were just hidden from plain view.
When you talk about two of the area water bodies that are very prominent and well known by name, Lake Warramug and Lake Lilinona, could you tell us the story behind Chief Warramug and I guess his daughter Lilinona? If you could just sort of convey to us who was Warramug, who was Lilinona, were they related, and some of the stories behind them?
Well, that's all mythology. I've been trying to figure out who Warramug was, and what I think, he was a charismatic leader, someone who was signing deeds in the late 17th through early 18th centuries. And he was a very important leader, became very important. If you ever go to where the metal bridges over the falls, etc., Lover's Leap, as they call it, there's signage up that talks about some of the archaeology that was done there. We were part of some of that. And it talks about the presence of Native people. There's a lot of archaeology that was done there at the falls. And they found this huge, huge area where people were living. And we think they've always been living there. So that Wiantanak, even though it's known from the 17th and 18th century, the peoples go back way before then. And Warramug became a leader because he was signing deeds. He was looked up to, I said, charismatic leader, someone who had the ability to reach out to the people and comfort them and also deal with the colonists who were taking the lands. And Warramugi became more important as more and more lands were sold. And he was signing a lot of those deeds, and he was signing deeds as well with Pututuck, Pagusset, and other folks. So people were moving up to Lover's Leap, known as Matachewan, where the waters swirl around. And there are some letters written about him. David Boardman was writing to John Barber in 1836. This is a manuscript at the Connecticut Historical Society. He said, Indian chief or sachem Warramug had a palace standing near the Great Falls where he resided. On the inner walls of the palace were pictures of every known beast, bird, fish, insect. This was said to have been done by artists whom a friendly prince at great distance sent to him for that purpose. In this palace, the aforementioned chief was visited by Reverend Daniel Boardman. He was the first minister in New Milford, and apparently he tried to convert him to Christianity. And Warramug definitely tried to save his lands. You know, he was only selling off stuff periodically, not the most important parts of his land. So he had his own reserve, which was between the east and west branches of the Chepauk River. That was his known reserve and the last place where he was living. Eventually, the native people had to sell that off, and his son Cherry moved the rest of them up to Scaticook, where there were already other native people starting to congregate. And like I said before, eventually the Moravians came there and started to work with them. And in terms of a daughter named Lilinona, I think that's all fabrication. I haven't found that he has a daughter named Lilinona, but it's a great story. There are all these myths that white people come up with to, I don't know, glorify the past, glorify native peoples, even as they're taking their lands. And the myth is that, you know, she fell in love with this white dude, and the guy leaves, and she's so distraught over his leaving that she either jumps off the cliff, she goes in her canoe off the fall, something like that. Just as she's committing suicide, he comes back and dives in after her so that they can both die together. I mean, it's just this bizarre white mythology. So that's what I know about Lilinona and Warramug.
The story you tell about selling off the lands to English settlers coming in wanting more land just suddenly dawned on me. It seems very much like what happens today, but in a completely different context, of when farmers are selling off their beautiful acreage to developers who come in and put up houses. There's a connection there of some sort. Is there not in your mind as well?
I never thought about that before, but that's true. You know, the people that know the land the best, that can take care of it, are squeezed. They don't have the wherewithal, the means to protect those lands anymore, whether it's cash on one hand or human power on the other. And so they're forced to move off their own lands, lands that they've known for very long periods of time that they've been farming. I mean, there are parallels everywhere. I was listening to part of the 1619 podcast about Black farmers in the South who really were the backbone of this nation in terms of farming and knew it better than the people that came in after them who happened to be white, and yet they were forced to sell their lands. So yeah, there are a lot of parallels.
Wraps up this episode of Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. For those of you in Western Connecticut, you may want to drive by the Scaticook Indian Reservation in Kent. One of the saddest parts of the story behind the land that was given to them is its proximity to Rattlesnake Mountain. Many of the rattlesnakes in that region can be found near to where the tribe was forced to locate their reservation, on the western banks of the Housatonic River. I want to thank our guest for today's program, Dr. Lori Weinstein, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Western Connecticut State University in Danbury. The answer to this week's trivia question, the question was, the first law school in the U.S. was in Connecticut. What town was it in? Well, the answer is not New Haven and Yale University. Rather, it was in Litchfield, where the Tapping Reeve School was located. Next week on Amazing Tales CT, the story of how Tapping Reeve came to be, and the unbelievable roster of students who graduated and then went on to help shape the young United States. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is a production of True North Associates, LLC. This is Mike Allen. Be safe, and please stay healthy.